Thanks. Okay, all right, great. So thank you again. Good. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the work my group has been doing on open quantum systems in the context of cosmology or motivated by cosmology. And I should start by acknowledging that, of course, the hard work for what's been done in these next few slides is done by students. So people in red are, in order of seniority, graduate students I supervise on these projects, Sean, Unadi, Sharka, and Tommy. We've had some great collaboration with a couple of undergrads and some other graduate students at the IGC as well. So this is the system I'm interested in. It's a system that has a number of extremely tenacious puzzles, and those puzzles have to do with the nature of physics far beyond the standard model, probably the nature of quantum fields and gravitational backgrounds, probably also even the nature of quantum gravity. And the puzzles can all be framed as things that we can describe very well at the level of the Einstein equations, but that we can't describe at all at the level of microphysics. So perhaps most famously, we don't know the particle nature of the dark matter. We also don't know the particle physics that set the universe in motion, whatever that happened at the very beginning to give us this rich structure that we see today. And we don't have much of a clue what to do about the present day era of accelerated expansion. So about half my time these days is spent working on an approach to this question. But most of my career, I've focused on the second one, the origin of the density inhomogeneities. And the story I want to tell you today comes out of all of that work. And it starts really with thinking about the primordial era of inflation. So accelerated expansion that was supposed to start us off, give us the quantum fluctuations that seeded all of this structure. Pretty much every model of inflation that you can write down gives you a universe that in cartoon form looks something like this at the end of the day. So there's some patch, which is what we observe. And if inflation is very, very fine-tuned, then all it has to do is last long enough to put the largest scales we observe in causal contact. But a generic inflationary model produces exponentially more space than that. So if you knew how long inflation lasted, you could write down the radius of this blue thing, and that's all of the space that is sort of statistically similar to what we see. So the same field drove the accelerated expansion. The same fields were fluctuating to give you the spectrum of perturbations. And an interesting question for inflation is, does all that extra space actually matter? If every single, you know, observable bubble that you wrote down in this space was independent, your answer would be no, it doesn't matter. For that to be true, what you need is that every mode of fluctuations is decoupled from every other mode. And in the many years that many of us spent thinking about interactions during inflation and non-Gaussianity, it became clear that you could have that happen, but you don't have to. Anytime you have a system of quantum fields where some of the things that are observable, degrees of freedom that are observable, are coupled or interacting potentially with degrees of freedom that are unobservable, that's an open quantum system. So I would say open quantum systems are really the right framework in which we should be thinking about inflation, for example. For inflation, of course, this is particularly important because we think we have data, right? We spend a lot of time, for example, trying to make better measurements of the CMB temperature and polarization to really pin down the statistics of those fluctuations in the hope that those are going to be, you know, give us the key to what the primordial physics was in terms of the particle physics. So this is a sort of the canonical plot. This one is taken from a CMB stage 4 forecast, where you're looking at the scale dependence of the scalar fluctuations, the temperature amplitude, if you like, in the CMB, compared to constraints on the amplitude of tensor modes in the CMB. And we have current constraints, and we build better and better instruments to push those constraints down. And the whole point is we like to make this plot because we can put particle physics models of inflation on the plot in the sense of the predictions that they give us for what we should observe. And what we'd really like is if we can get these constraints small enough that there's a small family or even just one compelling model that fits that data, and we say, ah, we know what the particle physics of inflation is. In the context of this picture, though, you know, we're really doing, when we ask what are all the things, the space of things that could be consistent with the data, we're really doing a sort of effective theory for this patch. And it's effective theory that can't see these very long wavelength modes, can't see the stuff that's in the IR. So it's really an open effective theory. And if we think about the global theory, it has to say what the prediction is not just for us, but for them and for them, for example, for the entire ensemble of possible post-inflationary observers. So the global theory of the whole thing is really an ensemble of open systems that have been put together in a consistent way to form this picture of the whole expanding, accelerated expansion space. This general idea that when we have quantum fields in gravitational space-times, we need to take an open systems approach is far more general than inflation. And the reason is easy. The reason is that gravity creates boundaries for observers, but those aren't boundaries that are hard boundaries in terms of the flow of information or the flow of energy. Here's a familiar picture of a possible boundary. Here's a de Sitter space, which has, of course, a de Sitter horizon. Here's the cosmological picture. There are lots and lots of boundaries in cosmology. And whenever you write down the quantum theory for fields within those regions, for any observable region, that's an open quantum theory. There's also this interesting feature that in many of these systems, different observers have different boundaries. So usually when we draw a diagram for de Sitter space, there's some observer at one edge, right? Really, if you take an observer that's far away over there, it has a different de Sitter horizon. So different observers have different parts of the space that they can see. And an interesting way to think about that is, what are the constraints on how you can put open systems together in compatible ways? So that if you have observers over here, observers over here, that perhaps share some part of the space-time that they can actually understand or actually view or reconstruct in some way, how can you do that consistently? So these notions have been very much in the literature recently from a variety of perspectives. There's a lot of literature on this. These are just a few. There are many more. But it's sort of a growing consensus that if we really want to grapple with doing quantum systems in gravity, we need to grapple with this open systems approach and the fact that different systems have different boundaries and see different things. Right, here's my open system building block, right? It's a very hairy building block. It's not a nice Lego. It's got all these legs, tentacles going out into the environment. So I got to put those things together. Okay, open systems in cosmology, though, is not a new idea. I mean, it was recognized from very early times that if you're doing quantum systems in systems with boundaries in gravity, that you have to do open systems. So you can find this idea back in the 1970s. Certainly, it was used in early studies of black holes, where, for example, you might take a scalar field, trace out what's on the inside, and use that as a mechanism to get the area law. And from the early days of inflation, it was also, again, realized that really you should be doing open systems. And some people have followed that thread through. But by and large, that perspective sort of fell by the wayside, and not many people worked on it. I think there are a couple of reasons why. One is just that what was known in the 1970s, early 1980s about open systems was not a whole lot. I mean, people knew how to do basic stuff for open systems, but they didn't know a whole lot. It's this nice little thin book by Davies. That's cool. My boundary. How do I put it together again? Cool. The gods will do it. Okay, great. Thanks. So that's the 1980s. And what happened since then is that open systems have been studied extensively outside of cosmology. So I didn't give you the nice angle on view where you can all see how thick Brewer and Petruccioni is, right? But many of you probably know how thick it is. And by now, this is old. So the thickness of new results on the archive since then is also enormous, right? And of course, the reason this happened is that open systems became extremely important for things that are happening in the lab, and they became extremely important for technology. Quantum computers are open systems, right? Dissipative systems, you need to understand the effects of that dissipation, and ideally, you need to try to control it so that your environment does something for you besides just screw up your calculation. So open systems have been extensively studied. Technology has developed. And at the same time, there's been a resurgence of interest from the point of view of cosmologists. And I think for many of us, I guess Cliff isn't here, I didn't confirm this, for many of us, this really came about from all of that thinking that happened about interacting fields during inflation, thinking about non-Gaussianity, thinking about how you self-consistently do those interactions over, for example, very long times that happen for de Sitter space. So again, this is not a complete list of people that work on this, but there's a resurgence of interest. And what we've been asking in our group, you know, we did some work on open systems approach to inflation, but in some ways, it was very hard to parse out the detailed physics that we wanted to get, the quantitative physics, hard to parse out the quantum effects. And so we decided that what we should do is go back and say, well, if we're going to start at the foundations and we want to build a foundational theory that should hit the really difficult questions in cosmology and gravity, what would we do? And we decided to take an approach, and here I'm stealing a term from Steve Giddings, to do a quantum-first approach. So we're going to start with quantum systems. In fact, we're going to start with open quantum systems because that seems to be the basic building block that we need to talk about what's happening in gravity. And we want gravity to come second. This is going to be quantum first gravity, which means that in the quantum systems, we want to try to some extent to stay away from assumptions about local structure, where things sit, who interacts with who. And again, because we want to aim at situations where we know that a single observer doesn't see the whole space, we want to think about ensembles of open systems and how do you put those ensembles together consistently. And I am a cosmologist, and I know that whatever quantum gravity does, and it may do many things, it certainly gives me this. So I want to study what that picture tells me that I should focus on. And that picture tells me that I should focus on disordered systems, systems that are inhomogeneous, out of equilibrium, slow to thermalize. And in some sense, that also makes sense that this is the right place to ask questions about putting open systems together, because if systems are thermal, big box of gas, and you take the clump of gas from over here and you swap it with the clump of gas from over there, who cares, right? It's a thermal system. On the other hand, things that are out of equilibrium may have very, very different behavior for some subsystems than they do for the whole. Doing this, though, requires a pretty serious foray into quantum systems. So that's what we've been doing. We've been really trying to build models that are simple in the sense that they're, you know, few spins for quantum systems. That still never means simple, truly. But they are small enough that we can try to really understand all of the aspects of the open system dynamics in an interesting way. So for the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is show you some steps we've taken in that direction that I think are promising. And I'm going to start by just treating a very familiar system, a spin chain, from the view, if you like, point of view of a cosmologist. And I'm going to look at it as an ensemble of open systems. That's nice because I can construct tools that I can use to then benchmark my results that I get for things that are a little more funky on something that's very familiar from the lab. And so after showing you how to do that, I'm going to then introduce these notion of these tiny universes that we've constructed and show you how we've been analyzing those. So I'm taking a universe that's exponentially huge and complex. I'm turning it into a very tiny universe. If you like, my cow has become very spherical, but I can hope to make progress there. I should point out also that everything I'm going to talk about in this talk are qubits, but you know, you might be interested in what you do with continuous variable systems, oscillators, and my student Sharka has some work that's on anharmonic coupled oscillators and mixed states and tracing out oscillators. Okay, let me start with my ensemble description of spin systems. So here's a system that's familiar. It's Hamiltonian for a collection of n spins arranged in a one-dimensional line. These are the Pauli operators, so these are Pauli Zs, sets the energy for each spin. I have nearest neighbor interactions, Pauli X operator, Pauli Y operator, possibly some different amplitude of coupling for the nearest neighbor Z interaction. And to make this super concrete and few body, let's just take four spins arranged in a little ring. So those are the nearest neighbor interactions that we want to do. Super small. And I want to look at this not as a condensed matter person who has each of these things in my lab and sits there looking at the whole thing. But I want to see how I can break it up into open systems. So the first thing I might do is I might take any one individual spin and treat it as an open system where the environment is the other three. Go over here and treat this one as the open system and this one and this one. I could take any two at a time, for example. And of course, if I put the ensemble of those things together, I get back a different description of the entire spin ring or spin chain. Okay, so what am I doing technically when I do that? I want to write down the evolution of just a system. That goes by this thing that's the generalization of the Schrodinger equation. That applies when you have open systems. So if this had just been a familiar system, d by dt of the system would depend on Hamiltonian of the system. But instead, I have all these new terms, which are gains and losses to the environment. And the way I need to describe the system also changes from the standard pure state, right? I need to be able to describe mixed states as well. So in a little more detail, I'm talking about the time evolution of density matrices. There's always a modification of the Hamiltonian from the environment, right? That's the part that's super familiar to particle physicists. That's your low energy EFT, your effective Hamiltonian, your effective Lagrangian. And then there's all the fun stuff, which is the non-unitary part that tells really how the system gives you sort of very complex and interesting behavior that's not familiar from undergrad quantum mechanics. And how do I do this formally for this system? Well, I just choose one of the spins that's going to be my system. The other three are going to be the environment. If I know the full, I specify some initial state for the whole system. I go ahead and evolve it with the Hamiltonian. And then I sort of close my eyes to the details of the environment. I trace over the environment, and it gives me the density matrix at a later time for just the system. I'm going to use a particular formalism for describing this, which is not the same as the master equation. I find it much more convenient. Master equation, even though it's nice and it looks familiar, it's hard to write down outside of perturbation theory, write down and solve. It's hard to write down if things are very non-Markovian. You may have some complicated non-local time dependence in that equation. On the other hand, if I do a formulation in terms of a dynamical map, which I'll explain a bit more in a second, I can easily handle all of those cases. I don't have to have weak coupling. I don't have to make assumptions of Markovianity or time locality, any of that. So this is a little bit more comfortable of a description that allows me to explore a broader set of interactions between system and environment. Dynamical map is the generalization of the unitary operator, right? So before we had the generalization of the Schrodinger equation, had the Hamiltonian and then the new operators that come into the evolution, this thing generalizes unitary evolution. If you had a standard pure system, closed system, you would just slap the unitary operator on either side, and away you go. You get the density matrix at time t. Dynamical map effectively does the same thing. It tells me how to take my system at time t1 and map it to a system at time t2. It's just that it can do that for non-unitary evolutions. And for the systems I'm going to describe, these dynamical maps are just 4x4 matrices. So they're pretty simple to parameterize in the sense of not too much information, just a few free functions. And the reason that they're 4x4 matrices, you can imagine, for example, taking that density matrix. Whoops, I think it's me touching the screen accidentally. Is that possible? I don't know. It's like an electrical contact. Anyway, where's my matrix? Or my vector, there it is. So take the density matrix, turn it into a vector, and then since that's a 4-entry vector, of course, to take density matrices to density matrices, you need a 4x4 matrix. I'm going to further restrict, actually, to, and the students were asking some great questions about this, what do my dynamical maps look like? Here it is. They're simpler than the most generic thing that you can do on a qubit system, in the sense that there's some zeros that don't have to be there in general. The most important thing for my purposes is that at any one time, there are three real parameters that are important, lambda 1, tau 3, and lambda 3. And if I make sort of a family of parameterized dynamical maps, then there are three real functions that are important. If you'd like to think about the block ball, these functions are telling you how the map is shifting the block ball in the z-axis. They're telling you how you're sort of deforming the block ball in the z-direction. And then there's an xy symmetry, and lambda 1 is telling you how do you deform in the xy direction symmetrically. These dynamical maps are of a type that I can easily get for a number of spin chains and spin systems that I'm interested in. So they turn out to be convenient because I can benchmark them again on those sort of laboratory systems. But they're also going to show up in the framework that I want to do for my mini universes later. So now I can really show you what this spin chain looks like as an ensemble of open systems. I'm going to specify an initial state. Basically, for each spin, I'm going to take just a component that's in the proportional to the Pauli Z operator. So these are the Z components of that specification for the states. For simplicity, I'm just going to put one interaction scale in the problem. So all the couplings in the Hamiltonian are the same. And what I want to do is first consider this purple spin as the system, the yellow spin as the system, the blue spin as the system, the orange spin as the system. So I can write down a whole set of dynamical maps where for each of the spins, I have the functions indexed by the spin that I'm looking at, lambda 1, lambda 3, and tau 3 as the important ones. And you might not be surprised that if I plot for you what one of those functions looks like, for example, so here I'm plotting this tau 3, the shift of the block ball in the z-axis as a function of time based on the only scale that's in the problem, the coupling j perp. I get things that oscillate. That's probably no surprise. It's a very small closed system, right? There's no dissipation. Stuff has to oscillate. And basically, the spread that you get and how different the maps are from each other is basically inherited from the difference in the initial states. So for some initial states, that spread gets pretty small. For this initial state, that's about as big as that spread gets. So that gives you what the ensemble looks for this spin state. And you can write it down for sort of arbitrary, not quite arbitrary, but relatively large family of initial states. We did this. This is an example for 4 in a ring. You can do it for a certain number of, you can keep doing this process. Of course, so it becomes technically harder as you go to higher spins. For things that are networks, actually fully connected networks, it's easier. And so we can write down to pretty high n. In fact, we can make an ansatz for all n, what a simple limit of these dynamical maps looks like. So this is a way of building up ensembles of maps that we know sort of come out of familiar laboratory systems. And then we can use those again as a benchmark for the maps that we see later. So this is a work that's been led by my student, Sean. Actually, I think I have his picture. Do I have his picture? There we go. There's Sean and Tommy. And these guys are the masters of doing all the combinatorics and crazy stuff to calculate very large n limits for dynamical maps. OK, so that's the cosmologist's view of a laboratory spin system. Let's move away from that, and let's ask what we want to do to go back to cosmology. And the first thing I want to do is relax the fact that I knew what those spins were. They were all arranged in a line, and I knew they had nearest neighbor interactions. And then I'm going to add this piece at the bottom as well. OK, so these are the tiny universes. And a lot of credit here goes to my student, Unati, who worked on this paper we had a few years ago and who has really been leading the charge on most of the results I'm going to show you. Jackson was kind of our guru of writing the code that allows us to go up to 16 qubits, which is the most that we can do at the moment. OK, so I want to relax this structure. I'm going to take 4 of these little rings, because the most I can do is 16 qubits. So let's take 4 little rings and ask what happens if we relax their interaction structure. So the first thing I'm going to do is say, instead of insisting that you all have nearest neighbor interactions, What I'm going to do instead is just pick some allowed connectivity graph. So what this graph means is that each of the nodes is a qubit. Each line tells me that it's possible to have a unitary that directly couples to this guy and this guy, say. But I'm not going to allow any unitaries in this particular example that couple these two spins and these two spins, for example. So that gives me, you know, a little bit away and allows me to play with sort of the connectivity that's allowed in this system. And so here's an example. I could allow, for example, at time t1, I could allow this interaction. Time t2, I might allow this interaction. And in other words, what I'm doing at the same time is I'm taking away this Hamiltonian, which specified who interacted with who at all times. And I'm moving to a picture where, because I want the, if you like, the interaction domains to be fluid and to be able to update, I'm moving to a picture where I'm taking discrete time steps and acting with some unitary on various systems, right? I choose the domain, I act with the unitary, and then I can trace out everybody else, for example. What I like about this picture is that it's a notion of co-evolving spin systems, right? In some sense, there's stuff going on over here, there's stuff going on over here, and then sometimes they can talk to each other. And that's a little bit more complicated and interesting than just a spin chain from my perspective. Anyway, not that spin chains aren't complicated. I shouldn't even apply that. Okay. A simpler picture, or maybe a more intuitive picture of what I'm doing, in fact, is that we're just doing a quantum circuit. So the connectivity tells me, if these are all of my spins, the connectivity just tells me which of these unitaries I'm allowed to draw. And for this connectivity, as a function of time, I might choose these interaction domains, then these, for example. So these are really quantum circuits. If I think about what's happening from the open systems perspective, there's a couple of interesting points. So, you know, go back to your picture of four closed rings. For any one set of four spins here, any ring, of course, this is unitary. And the unitary evolution has this wonderful property that I can go from time t0 to t2 by chopping it up at any time I want at intermediate times. And you know, I still know that it's unitary on both sides of that, and I know exactly what that operator is. Once I move over here and I have these, again, consider a four spin set, just to make contact with that, you know, it's a four spin set that can interact with various things. And so they're really open systems. And so I have some dynamical map for that evolution. And the interesting, one of the interesting features there is that now if I look at the map that takes me from time t1 to time t3, and I want to chop it in the middle, those pieces don't have the same properties as the full map. And they have all kinds of interesting other features in there, which give me a clue about the dynamics that's going on. Basically, you know, is it Markovian, for example? These things aren't the same. And by looking at how they're different and what the properties are, I can get some notion of the dynamics that's actually happening on the system. OK. The other thing, as promised, as advertised, is that when we make a few restrictions on this, which I like for a number of reasons, we get dynamical maps of the same form as we did over here. This theta is kind of an unimportant function, so think of this as theta equals 0 in this example. It's of the same form. How do we get this restriction? We get it by insisting that all of the interactions commute with the free Hamiltonian. So we've set free Hamiltonian for each of these things to be the same, like a simple sigma z term. We insist that u commutes with h. And we also insist that we choose special initial states. We choose each qubit, or each spin, if you like, to be in a, have a density matrix that's diagonal in the basis of its free Hamiltonian. So if you like, it's like a thermal state. It has some population in the ground state, some population in the excited state. So those two restrictions, which in some sense you can think of as starting in a very classical state. Everything looks more or less thermal and tensor product of thermal states. It allows us to see what happens as quantum correlations develop. It also gives us relatively easy to control thermodynamics because I've made this restriction, so I understand how to compute various thermodynamic quantities in a way that makes sense. And it has a form that looks familiar from a variety of other systems. One of the systems that it looks like, but that it's not quite, is actually just a thermalizing map. So go back to the story that I want to understand the out of equilibrium nature of my system. This is almost like this thing called the Davies map, which, you know, if I take any particular spin and I hit it with this map repeatedly, it's going to drive my spin to a thermal state that's just determined by this population in the ground and excited state. So it has that form, but it's not restricted in the same way that this map is. So we can have a limit where these maps end up looking thermalizing and a limit where they don't. And so that's one way that we can study what's happening in these tiny universes. Yeah, so it's not restricted. Okay, and I think I said this before, actually, you know, but again, part of what I want to do is understand what are the consistency conditions for putting open systems together. And if I think about thermalized systems, that's not a particularly good place to get strong constraints. I need to think about systems that are not thermalized, and then I'm going to have sharper consistency constraints. So that's what I'm doing. Out of equilibrium is the story of why the subsystems are interesting, basically. Okay. So if I'm going to say that out of equilibrium is interesting, I have to tell you how I know that things are out of equilibrium. And I'm going to use two different measures to do this, one that's possibly not familiar, one that probably is. The first measure I'm going to use is extremely thermodynamic. It's the extractable work. And the second is a measure that occurs in a variety of contexts where people want to try to, you know, see if they can diagnose phase transitions or quantum critical points, things like that, which is going to have to do with the mutual information, in particular the graph of mutual information between each of these pairs of spins, for example. And I should say that this story is related to this very interesting story that, you know, especially lately, there's been a lot of activity about understanding when it is that closed systems thermalize, when it is that they don't, what are the properties that allow them to sort of resist thermalization. But the tools that we're going to use are sort of suited to this situation where you may not know the full Hamiltonian, you may not know the eigenstates, you may have a very dynamic, evolving set of connections, and you want to still understand if things are thermalizing or not. Okay, so let me start with the extractable work. So the reason that I like this, and we started doing this after reading this paper of Kolchinsky et al., the reason I like this is that it's to me, a very physical measure of, are the things in my universe able to do something interesting, basically, by a level of interesting that I think I can, you know, tie to machines or batteries or something like that. So extractable work just says I take my system, not in any particular state, and I ask how much work I can get by bringing that system into contact with a thermal bath. Clearly, if the system is at the temperature of that bath, not interesting, right? So this is really something that's dependent on the relationship between the system and the environment, if you like, relation between the system and the thing you want to try to extract work from. Formally, this is the difference between the free energy, which I can define for an out of equilibrium state of the state I've got, and the free energy of an equilibrium thermal state. And there's a very useful rewriting of that where I can write it as depending on the temperature of this reference thermal state, and the relative entropy, so how different my state is from the thermal state. And that's going to be important as we think about the dynamics going forward. And what I'm particularly interested in are evolutions where the extractable work can increase. So like systems can undergo a process where later on they're even more able to stay away from equilibrium in some sense, right, in some rough sense. So we're going to be particularly interested in that as a sign of systems that stay and persist and have sustainable out of equilibrium dynamics. Okay, can I do this for my mini universes? Yes, what am I doing? Basically, I'm considering that, again, I can choose any one of these little components of my universe and treat that as the system. And the bath, you know, this is the whole universe. There is nothing else. I don't want some external bath. It's all in the universe. So the only sense in which I'm asking, is this state useful compared to what? Is it useful compared to the rest of the universe? So I want to define the rest of the universe to be given by the rest of those systems with some average temperature. And the only reason that we can do this in some sort of systematic way that kind of makes sense is because we'd impose those conditions on the interaction structure and on the initial states. So those restrictions together mean that any individual piece of this universe started in what looks like a thermal state. It's just some fraction in the ground state, some in the excited state. The restriction on the dynamics means that whenever I go to some later time and trace out everything except one of the systems, it's still in a thermal state. So for each of the individual systems, I can define something like a temperature, which means that I can define something like a temperature for the rest of the landscape by taking the average of those temperatures. This is an extremely classical notion of what I'm doing for temperature. You can do other things where you try to put the correlations into the temperature, but for my purposes, this very classical notion works really well. We'll see the correlations come out in other places. So, you know, what do these things look like? I'm going to show you this for 8 qubits. And what I'm showing, this is time. The different patches across are different connectivities that I'm allowing on the landscape. So do I allow everybody to talk to everybody, for example, or some restricted connectivity in my circuit? This is a random circuit, so I'm just taking random unitary, random domains, basically, and some unitary that obeys my condition. And things that are orange have a positive change in extractable work at each step. Things that are blue have a negative change in extractable work at each step. And the only thing that you should see here is that if I allow all-to-all connectivity, things get very speckledy very fast. If you somewhat restrict the connectivity, you start to get these longer portions where, for example, a single part of the system will have a longer place where it has increasing extractable work. And so you get different structure from different connectivities. Okay, but what I really wanted to do is pull out, you know, what does this mean? And in particular, can I pull out what the point is of having a quantum system do this. I set everything up very classically. I have this classical notion of temperature. What's the point of having the quantum system? And when I look at that again as this sort of ensemble of maps, can I point to any consistency conditions on how I might, you know, take these things and put them together, right? Because all I've done is put this sort of network interaction structure on them, but how could I actually arrange them in some local system, for example? And before I tell you that story, let me contrast with, again, what happens with that Davies map. Let me contrast with a standard picture of thermalization. So let me take all the spins in my little universe, pull them apart, and introduce them to another universe, which is a big bath. And instead of interacting with each other, they're each going to have repeated interactions with this bath system at some temperature T, which I can, again, take to be the average temperature of the initial states I started with, and just keep doing that. So this is a thermalizing picture. What happens? And what happens, of course, is that in that case, the extractable work just monotonically decreases. If you have the non-thermalizing picture, so this mini-universe picture, this stuff fluctuates. And I think that, you know, that's a result that's been in the literature for a few years. But the collision just decreases. Okay. Let's do something a little bit more interesting. Let's not just interact with some bath. Let's still allow our system to have these dynamical domains where the system interacts within the universe. But let me throw out the correlations at each step. So that's kind of a milder notion of dissipation. I'm just going to, you know, with each interaction, the parts of the universe become correlated, but let me just throw them out at each step and ask what happens. So I'm again showing you delta work extractable, but I'm also showing you change in temperature, because in this case, that's basically all that's driving the change in extractable work. I threw out all the correlations. It's just that temperature, that classical part that's at work here. You can see stuff fluctuates, but again, it sort of decreases non-monotonically down to this just little fuzzy noise here. But it is non-monotonic, and that makes sense because we have this evolving temperature in the universe. Okay. How is that different from the full evolution? The full evolution does not have a monotonic decrease in extractable work. It keeps oscillating. Again, maybe that's not surprising. It's a small, relatively small system. It's closed within itself, and so you expect to have these continued pattern of fluctuations. What is interesting is if you zoom in on some region of this plot, and I think this is right over here, you find that the change in temperature can be negative, while the change in extractable work can be positive. That's interesting because what's shown in this paper for a wide variety of classical stochastic processes and some typical quantum processes is that that doesn't happen for typical processes. Basically, it doesn't happen, you know, I'm going to say what typical means in a minute, but for any classical process and for typical quantum processes, you don't get that happening. And there's an additional criteria that the evolution is Gibbs preserving. It takes thermal states to thermal states, which I showed you my evolution is. You know, under these circumstances, the temperature of the reservoir has to go up in order for you to have an increase in extractable work. So what's going on here? What's going on here has to do with the story of the maps. So let's consider the map, a dynamical map that takes a state or a density matrix at time t1 to a density matrix at time t2. But let's suppose that the system and environment were entangled at that initial time instead of being in a product state. So this is just, sorry, maybe this is a little bit too technical, but again, a typical dynamical map I would derive with this product state, the unitary evolution, I take the trace. Let's replace that thing by an entangled state. And then it turns out that the evolution is not typical in the sense that it doesn't always have to take any conceivable density matrix you give it to a good density matrix. And technically, it's not completely positive. This evolution arises naturally in the middle of the landscape, because of the middle of the universe, because the universe, after all, was correlating different pieces together. So it's not true that at time t15, you know, I have unentangled or uncorrelated states between the system and environment. So in some ways, I don't think it's a surprise that you can end up with these non-positive maps. But it does mean that, you know, you're getting information back. The states can become more distinguishable because the environment was holding on to that information and it can give it back to you, basically. So we get these non-positive maps, intermediate time steps, which means we have basically a non-standard relationship for what happens to the relative entropy, which ties back into what's going on with the thermodynamics. You can show this all technically, you know, by taking actual little examples of how this works and looking at the behavior of the individual components of the map. You can show that when you do this bit about throwing out correlations after each step, you know, these functions then, as a function of time, they're sort of products of all of the things that came before. And you can show that repeated, you know, time steps of doing this interaction and throwing away correlations gives you something that's always completely positive. You can sort of see how things damp with time. And actually, this drives your states toward the sort of a fixed state, if you like. That's the completely mixed state. So technically, the map is unital. On the other hand, you can also do an exercise where you include correlations of the type that we get in the little universe, carry this exercise forward, and it's very easy to see that, you know, this, in particular, this function here changes in such a way that the conditions for complete positivity don't have to be satisfied in that map. So it's definitely the interactions, the correlations that are building up between system and environment that give you this non-CP behavior. So why do I care about that, actually? I think it's pretty interesting, because what that means is that, you know, if you look at this point in your universe and you say, well, this map that's acting here now doesn't take every state to a good quantum state. And if you look at the domain of positivity, it can even mean that if I just pick something up from over here on the other side of the universe and I want to plop it in, like swap their position and have them go forward, I don't get necessarily good physical evolution. So that starts to look a little bit like an interesting constraint on how can I arrange locally or how can I move around locally the degrees of freedom in my system due to that domain of positivity. Right, because the environment cares what's going on. Right, it's not just the system; it's a system and environment. Okay. But if we want to come up with the strongest constraints we possibly can on how can we arrange and have dynamics of these systems that look sort of like local motion in a particular space, we should find which evolutions are the most complex, the most out of equilibrium, because those are going to probably give us the strongest constraints on what happens. So part of what we've been doing is try to design systems that are the farthest from equilibrium we possibly can get them. Which circuits are the most complex? And to do that, you know, what I showed you before was all sort of random domains. So I choose a domain according to my connectivity. I act with some unitary, and I look at the evolution. That already does interesting things. But we can do better if we sort of tune the domains of interaction according to some prescription. And the really interesting thing probably is if you have a rule for domains of interaction that cares about what the environment is doing, because then you have some hope of driving yourself further and further from equilibrium. And there are some well-known examples of this. And you can think of them as, you know, rules for how the update goes that depends on the state of the environment. These are sometimes called kinetic constraints. They also might be familiar from sort of a cellular automata point of view. But basically, it just means that, you know, what happens to this spin? Well, let's say it flips only if both of its neighbors are spin up, and otherwise it does nothing. These are interesting rules. You can certainly write down Hamiltonians that do that. They just need to sort of project on the neighbors, right, and then have the spin flip of the guy in the middle. So this is a well-studied Hamiltonian that has that kind of physics. And it's sort of known to be interesting. It has some special eigenstates, right, that don't thermalize particularly well. So you know, we know this does something interesting, this kind of behavior. Unfortunately, this is not easily consistent with our rule. So we don't want to do that exactly. And it's actually missing what I think is a key piece of physics as well that we want to get at when we study these universes. And that is that rule depends on what's happening in the neighbors. It doesn't care what the state of the system is in the middle, right? It just says flip. You flip if your neighbors are this. So it's not really a relational rule. It's a rule that just depends on the environment. So we can instead write down relational rules, updates that depend on state of system and environment. And we can do that in a way that still restricts, that still satisfies this condition. So we can still use all of our sort of good thermodynamics going forward. And this is a lot more compatible with what we think is like the interesting utility of a subsystem, right? A subsystem's utility depends not just on its state, but on its state with respect to what's happening in the rest of the universe. So that's what we want to get at. You can do this in a variety of ways. I'm going to show you one thing, which is sort of like cheating, because we give every single degree of freedom knowledge about the global thermal state of the little universe. And we allow it to try to stay away from that state as much as possible. So to choose its interaction based on what's going to keep it as far away as possible from that thermal state. There are some other more fun things you can do where you only give local information. I'm not going to talk about those now, but I'm happy to later. And this is where we're going to come and use a more standard complexity measure, which is based on mutual information. And it's based on taking the set of spin systems that you have and computing the mutual information between every pair. People often represent that as a network where, again, each of the circles is a particular, you know, subsystem, like one of the spins. The lines are the mutual information between any two of those. The line thickness is the strength of the mutual information. And when the little node, when the nodes are clustered, it's because they're sort of more tightly connected. They have more shared mutual information between them. I picked this particular graph because it's a graph from a paper that looked at a whole bunch of different update rules and asked which of them give you the most complexity. And this was the one that was the most complex. So this is sort of like a target mutual information graph that we might try to see if we can get. OK. So I'm going to show you what happens with these various update rules. This is really the work of Unati. I'm going to show it to you in a variety of ways. First, just for reference, this is sort of one of those temperature swaths for the random update rule. So this is how the temperature changes as a function with time. There was one hot qubit. And you know, there's no reason actually to even show this, because everything basically becomes pretty close to the same temperature, and they're just small fluctuations. So it's pretty much thermalized, if you like, at the level this small system can thermalize. On the other hand, if you do this greedy rule and you ask people want to stay as much as possible away from the global thermal state, of course you don't get anything like that. You get the formation of little domains, right? So the first step was random, and then we allow the individual systems to try to stay away from the thermal state. And you get back to a picture that looks sort of like those distinct domains, things basically not interacting with each other, except for maybe some little weak interactions between some of the subsystems. So it looks very different. So you might expect that all of those other measures also look very different. So now I'm going to show you the graphs of mutual information for the rule that tries to stay away from thermal equilibrium and the rule that doesn't. It's just sort of random. And so you can see a lot of structure in the mutual information in that first case. And you can see, on the other hand, that if you just do random domains, everything very quickly becomes a little net. So probably not surprising, not that complex. So clearly, as a graph, this thing is more complex. It has more variation in like the strength of, you know, each individual line coming out of any particular node. There's some clustering. It's just, you know, this is sort of very homogeneous, if you like. Okay, so you can make a graph that's much more complex with mutual information. Is it useful? So now you can go back and compare to, for example, things like the extractable work. So here, this is a simpler visualization of the mutual information. It's just the mean. So at every time step, compute the mean of all of those systems. And that thing oscillates up and down for the greedy rule with, you know, relatively big, I'm not giving you a scale for what these numbers mean, but you know, this rule that tries to avoid thermalization has a lot more large fluctuation than this rule that doesn't try to avoid thermalization. So it's definitely less thermalizing, more complex. And you see that reflected in what the extractable work is doing, for example. So this is a plot of the total extractable work. So just like here, we've taken the average of mutual information. Probably we should have averaged this, but it's actually just the sum over all the pieces of the universe. And you can see it has a fair bit of structure that goes. I didn't plot this one because it's basically just some really small noise along the axis here. So you clearly see reflected in a property of, which is, you know, plot of mutual information, which you think has something to do with interesting physics, but it's not a priori clear what in this context, right? In another context, maybe you're looking for phase transitions or whatever, but this is some clue of what it's doing for you in terms of useful physics and how the system stays away from equilibrium. Okay, so clearly this story is not done. There are a lot more things I could show you in that picture. I have very small universes. I could, you know, I haven't shown you very many consistency relations. But what we have done is to come up with a set of toy systems that, to me, get at sort of the key features of what we're confused about when we think about cosmology, or what we don't understand the physics of when we think about cosmology. And in contrast to when we try to apply like master equations to inflation, here it's easy to see what's happening due to non-Markovian stuff, which I can make as strong as I like. I can make interactions as strong as I like. It's easier to see what happens based on which systems can talk to which other, so connectivity and the domain of interaction. And I can also really pick apart what's going on that's due to classical correlations and what's going on due to quantum correlations. And furthermore, I can do this in a context where I can take something that has features that I like for cosmology, but I can compare it directly to systems that are very well studied in the lab, spin systems. And it allows us to sort of build up a set of tools that we can use to ask these questions and get some intuition. There are lots of interesting things to do next. I want to mention just a couple of things. You know, one of the most obvious ones, I think, is that you really want to know what happens as a function of subsize of the system, right? The size of the subsystem compared to the size of the whole landscape. So we did this for single spins, but you want to do it as you go back up to the picture of, say, all the four spins that are non-interacting, where the evolution in this case becomes unitary again. We go back and think about boundaries in cosmology. You know, it's frequently the case that things move in and out of system and environment. Right? In some sense, the boundary changes, right? You almost never do that when you do, say, a quantum computing system. You don't move things across the boundary from system or environment, but that happens all the time in cosmology. And with Sean, we did a very, you know, one particular example of that, but we'd really like to go back and do more, look at what happened, consistency relations as the boundary changes. And again, when I'm looking at, you know, making my cosmologist view of the spin system in the lab, I can put the boundaries anywhere I want, right? Nothing tells me there's something inconsistent about, you know, adding this spin to my subsystem. In gravity, that's not the case. There is something inconsistent about not having a boundary there in some space-times. So where is that coming from? Why do you have to have a boundary? What consistency relation tells you you have to have that boundary? So that's something we're aiming at. And then, you know, really, we've hardly gone a tiny step toward asking how you get sort of a local set of interacting degrees of freedom like we see in the universe. There's this really interesting idea that was put out a couple of years ago by Friedman and Zinni that what you really want to say is, okay, suppose I just have a really big Hilbert space. All of the Hamiltonians that we see are special in that space. They're not just random in that high-dimensional space. Instead, they break down into Hamiltonians for things like spins, few degree of freedom quantum systems, that have more or less local interaction, nearest neighbor interactions, for example. How do you get that structure to come out? And their idea, Friedman and Zinni, was that, well, what I should do is I should write, look at the space of sort of, you know, how do I weight different parts of that random set of Hamiltonians differently? I should define a metric that gives me a weight for how I do that. And so you can actually ask for metrics that are minima of certain functionals, for example, just the curvature on the manifold that describes that space. And it turns out that by doing that, surprisingly often, you get down to Hamiltonians that are preferred that have the structure of, say, qubits. So they call this nose about qubits. And that's one of the steps that you want. But it's not the only step you want, because once you define qubits, you still don't have a notion of, okay, but this one is fixed at this point, this one is fixed at this point, this is fixed at this point, and I have, say, a common reference frame that tells me, like, what is sigma z for all of those things, right? So defining qubits is still different from saying how those degrees of freedom actually sit somewhere and how they relate to each other. So I think a lot of interesting things to do to try to figure out how to put that additional structure that we know must be there on top of this system. Okay, so that's a lot of detail. I just want to come back to the big picture view of why we're doing this. Big picture view, again, is that we know, and it's increasingly recognized that it may be key to understanding puzzles in gravity and cosmology, that we should be treating these systems as open quantum systems. Our theory framework doesn't do that at all. It's not built to do that, right? We have a semi-classical gravity. We put some local quantum field theory on top of it. So I guess our bet is that a way to get new insight, or at least get out of the old habits of thinking on these problems, is to build something that from the ground up contains the two things that are really key for gravity and cosmology, open systems and out of equilibrium systems, because those are the interesting spacetimes, and that's the one that we've got. So those are the pieces we want to put together. And what's just really fun about this is, you know, it brings us new insights, but it's really also an opportunity to bring in progress that's happened over the past many decades in adjacent fields of physics that so far have not impacted the cosmological model. So progress on out of equilibrium, thermodynamics, progress on quantum information, quantum systems. It just seems like that's probably going to be relevant for our theory somewhere. And you know, the flip side of that, that sort of increase in you know, intuition that we get is that it's possible that bringing the cosmologist viewpoint into those systems will also bring something, a sort of new way of looking at them that's different from what you do when you're just interested in computation, for example. OK, I'll stop there. Thanks.
Great, thanks. So our vision is to first start off with discussion from students. So are there any student questions? Sure. Could you explain again what did you do with this? It was very early, actually. This connectivity thing. So what exactly do you have, the spins? And then instead of just unitary evolution for the whole thing, you do at one step you have one evolution, and then you change Hamiltonian. Is that what you do?
What we wanted to do at that first stage was to say, well, you know, very naively, if I think about how a system thermalizes, if I have everybody connected to everybody else, that should thermalize faster. If I have some restricted connectivity, probably it thermalizes slower. So let's build into the system the notion of an allowed connectivity graph. That tells me which domains I can act with unitaries on. And for reasons that I can explain, we wanted to have at least the ability to do four spins at once. So we build a bunch of graphs that we can scale up that allow me to have four spins interacting at once. But then indeed, what we do is, and for simplicity, just choose a single unitary out of the allowed set and have it act at each time on every set, but choose the domains according to some rule. Random would be the first, and then something, you know, if you think the rule has something to do with what the state of the environment is, then you can choose that second. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand. So that's supposed to mimic the dissipation, right?
Well, I guess what we thought is that that's clearly an element that's going to affect how much things thermalize. If I have lots of connectivity, I should expect things to thermalize faster. But can I really show the effect of that difference in connectivity? And in fact, on the other hand, if you have too restricted of connectivity, right, isolated domains, okay, then everybody's isolated. That's not particularly interesting either. So.
About the positive or negative extractable work, that's anywhere. Don't you violate the second law of thermodynamics?
No, right? Because in some sense, you really have to do the second law properly. And there are a number of papers on this in literature that I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is, really, when the environment contains that kind of information, you can't just treat the system locally. You need to treat the environment as well. And if you treat both of those things together, then you don't violate the second law. But locally, you get this kind of interesting behavior, which after all, we know is possible, right? I mean, I sustain useful tools all the time, and I'm not violating the second law.
So you showed the results for the greedy algorithm that has a global knowledge of the temperature, but you also mentioned that there was a local observation. Do you see similar results for that?
Yeah, so I don't have a full analysis of this yet, although I love it, so I couldn't resist mentioning it. Because that global information, that's probably not the right rule. Probably what's better, and there are some really interesting examples of this kind of mimicking rule in other contexts, that if instead, you look around and you say, oh, who did really well? Let me try to, do the same thing in terms of temperature or coherence or something is over there. That's local information, and then it's an interesting question about how that looks. So I don't have the full results, but that's the one that we're really interested in comparing as well now.
So any more questions from the whole audience, such as the students?
So very interesting, but I guess I'm now trying to picture. So when are we going to use this in cosmology?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, good question, Yash. Yeah, I mean, I think, so there are a couple of things that one might imagine doing, right? And as I think I said to one of the students earlier, there's maybe a few steps you might imagine. I think one thing that would be really interesting is if you could say, and this isn't immediately cosmology, but if you could say again, why is it that there must be consistency relations where there has to be a boundary to what the observer can see, for example? Why should gravity generate horizons, if you like? What tells me that should happen? So I think there are a few steps that we can take to get a different perspective on some aspects of gravity. I mean, ultimately, of course, then, once you've done that, what you'd like is some better understanding of where some of the phenomena that we see come from. So at an extreme example, do we have inflation with this inference problem? Or are we confused about what the primordial, the origin story should be about the universe? And maybe there's a prediction for primordial gravitational waves with that. That's pretty speculative. But you might imagine eventually ending up there. Can you say something about the cosmological constant? Which geometries are preferred for some reason once you start putting open systems together and asking that they do something interesting, right? That sounds a little bit like a story that we already know about the cosmological constant, but can you make that some precise thermodynamic story?
What a story are we talking about?
Sorry, so an anthropic story for the value of the cosmological constant, but forget anthropic, really make it thermodynamic in some interesting way. So, I don't know. I mean, it's a long way, but I think, I don't know. We've been trying, I should say, it's only been 20 years that I've been doing this. All the rest of you have been doing it for longer, right? But so I don't know. But we're not, I don't see us making conceptually new changes in how we think about the problems, and the problems aren't getting solved. So I guess I'm interested in trying to make a conceptual change.
But instead, I'm kind of trying to get a slightly more concrete roadmap of this. Yeah. I mean, imagine you're having much bigger computers, you can do more qubits of these. So how is that going to, what would be the new ingredient that could help us maybe get a space-time out of this?
So I think you'd want to know what are the consistency rules for how you put things together. And those consistency rules will probably depend on, the quantum degrees of freedom inside to some extent, so on the matter, which gives you rules for how the geometry has to go. So in some sense, that tells you something about how gravity has to be put together. And it tells you a consistency relationship between what's happening on the inside and what the global system is doing. And for example, you might say, so again, speculative, right? You might say, a typical way that we do cosmology now is we say FRW plus fluctuations. But what if I instead asked for a particular behavior of the ensemble of subsystems? And what I learned was that to support that behavior of ensemble of subsystems, you had to have sort of a particular emergent type of thermal bath in the whole, right? That's a very different way of asking what kinds of large-scale organizations of information are consistent with a particular organization of small-scale information. So maybe that starts to look more like a cosmological continent. I don't know. It's all very speculative, but that's the kind of thing that would be just interesting to ask.
So basically, you're thinking you could use a different basis to kind of build the cosmology on instead of a classical background with fluctuation, you have other subsystems and you could build
it. Yeah, so it really is a quantum first, which tells you how gravity should act, which gives you a different insight on the space-times that you build.
Just another one. In this, you had uniform coupling between all connected spins, I believe. But I could, and you're varying like the connection in the graph. But I could imagine having like the coupling varying between each nodes, and then you could maybe get a sense of geometry based on like the strength of.
Yes, that's right. Yes, there are many interesting things like that you can do. Exactly. And another interesting thing, of course, is to chop out connections, right? So in some sense, that's putting in a really sharp cut between who can interact with who and asking, and this maybe looks a little bit like, anyway, you know. So there are lots of interesting things like that. Yeah.
Online question?
So I think I got a little bit confused along the way, so I want to just make sure I understood it. So we talked about your four spin chain, and in that model, if I have all the spins, then I have something that evolves unitarily. It starts in a quantum state, or a quantum state, things are conserved, etc. And then you started changing in this larger network the connectivity, and as I understood it, this is one thing I'd like to clarify. You're dynamically updating the Hamiltonian effectively.
Yes.
Those quantum circuits we're drawing towards. So I throw away the idea that if I actually know about the whole system, it would evolve unitarily. And that's basically how you got all the interesting phenomena, because now, am I supposed to think of that as marginalizing over all the possible ways your subsystem connects to the bigger system? Or how do I think about that?
So I guess at a stepwise level, the system is evolving unitarily because I only act with unitary operators on some subset of spins. But it's true that the domains are changing, which is why you're getting some interesting stuff. So then what was the second part of the?
So now I want to connect it to cosmology. One way people like to think about quantum cosmology is that there's something called the wave function of the universe and it evolves unitarily, and you know, the interesting evolution we see is because we're some subsystem in a larger unitarily evolving system. So you still preserve that in your 16 spin network, where if I actually had the whole network and I understood the rules for dynamically updating the connectivity, that thing would evolve unitarily, that would start in from quantum state and stay in that quantum state forever and ever. And then, okay, good. So, one of the things that seems to work really well, again, to bring it back to cosmology, maybe this is actually a question. Part of thinking about that wave function of the universe does motivate the choice of the initial quantum state, like the Bunch-Davies mechanism.
Yes.
It comes out sort of naturally.
Yes.
So
yes.
You envision a way that something like that would come out of the ideas you're presenting here.
Yeah, so part of what we were interested in indeed is what's the relevance of the initial state? And can you impose some symmetries on the initial state that restrict what's happening in the environment, for example, and then that gives you a subclass of stuff that you see when you start doing this open systems picture. On the other hand, it's tempting to try to get away from the notion of initial state, I guess, because of this whole story of back and back and back. So I can imagine it going either way, that you really do have a notion of why some class of initial states matters, or you have this picture where you've almost removed, I don't know, you somehow don't have the same story of initial state and forward time evolution. What that looks like exactly, I don't know. But at some level, when you have dynamics of a closed system, in this context, what is time? What is time? It's a parameter through the state of the space state. And so what is, I don't know, what is time really? What should it be? I don't know. So.
May I? May I go ahead?
Well, Or can you type in the chat, Lee, actually?
No? I think I chat in the chat, but can you hear me if I speak loudly?
Yes.
That's better.
Good, okay. I admire what you're doing. And I'm trying to do something like it, and I know many people who do it. I start with maybe just limit myself to a simple question. Shouldn't we go in the other order? Shouldn't we ask what is a cosmological theory? And how does a cosmological theory differ from a theory of a subsystem? And invent a cosmological theory and derive the properties of subsystems from the larger theory?
Anyone parse that?
Oh, I didn't get that.
Shouldn't we start from the cosmological theory, ask the question, what does a theory need to be cosmological? Conclude that it has to be very different than the theory we're dealing with, and start from there and go backwards. In other words, postulate the cosmological theory and derive the open systems as limits of it.
Drive the open systems as limits of the cosmological theory.
Cosmological theory, yes.
I guess I'm not sure which open systems you mean. To some extent, we know concrete places where open systems, you know, can be applied within the cosmology we have. That's true.
Yeah. They're always approximate. Mm-hmm.
Are they always approximate?
They're always approximate.
Okay, good. So that, I mean, I'm sure that's true at the moment, because we can't describe those completely, and we don't know how to describe them completely. So I guess you're asking, can we figure out what all of the components are that I should put in that open system to get out all of the physics that I know is there? Is that the?
Yeah, I want you to start with cosmological systems, and notice that cosmological systems have a few properties that subsystems don't. Example, that there's no universe outside the universe. There's no observer outside the universe. Start there and go back to where you are.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess the audio is bad. I'm not completely sure I'm understanding. I'm happy to have an email exchange about that.
I think we're going to meet at some point. So I look forward to discussing.
Okay, sorry about that, Lee.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, so if there's no more questions, let's stop here.